Mr. Kerry-Packer, what seems to be the problem? There was, as it turned out, quite a problem, but we won't go into that here. But probably most of you don't remember that Malcolm Turnbull was a journalist before graduating as a lawyer. He was political correspondent for Nation Review, Radio 2SM and Channel 9, and he did a stint with Bulletin. He was admitted to the bar, Sydney Bar, in 1980, practised as a barrister, then joined Kerry-Packer as general counsel, and we won't go to that again. Later he made his name in successfully defending spy catcher Peter Wright and introduced a nice piece of Australian raw prawnism into your gentle profession. That done and a book written, he went into business, became managing director of the investment banker Turnbull & Partners, and leapt into the future with visions like the pioneering internet provider Aussie Mail. And he got mixed up with the Fairfax fascinations at the time. He keeps leaping ahead. I'm not quite sure now, but I think he's the chairman and managing director of Goldman Sachs Australia. But today we look at another Malcolm Turnbull, the passionate Australian Republican. He is chairman of the Australian Republican Movement, and in 1993, the then Prime Minister appointed him chairman of the Republic Advisory Committee. That led to this year's Constitutional Convention, and as we know, Malcolm's ARM was the biggest force in setting us for a referendum next year. I can now confess, Mr. Turnbull, that when you rang me all those years ago, we were wrong, and thanks for not taking us for all we had. You were right then. Are you right now about the Republic? Ladies and gentlemen, Malcolm Turnbull.
Thank you very much. I don't think I've ever been so eloquently and kindly introduced. A typically gracious and courteous Adelaide welcome. It's very good to be here. The Constitutional Convention had all of the hallmarks of complete disaster, or so it seemed to me. It had everything potentially wrong with it from my point of view, or the Republican movement's point of view. Firstly, we had 36 out of 152 delegates appointed by the Prime Minister intended to reflect, he said, every shade of opinion. I imagine that ranged from straight up and down monarchists to people who wanted to bring back the Stuarts and to a few who wanted to restore the Saxon kings, and then perhaps a couple of Bonapartists. I didn't anticipate there'd be any Republicans among them. But amazingly there were a few. There were 40 members of Parliament representing the state and territory and of course the federal parliament. The allocation of seats between those 40 parliamentarians reflected the deep commitment that our national parliament has to federalism and the importance of the states, and that's why there were 20 delegates from the federal parliament and only 3 from each state parliament. And then there were 76 elected delegates, of which I was one. And indeed, as Don said, the Republican movement had the largest delegation among the elected delegates. But what utter madness that was. A postal ballot where somewhere between 15 and 25% of the ballot papers never found their way to their addressees. And that is a large explanation of why so many young people didn't get ballot papers, because, of course, as we all remember, from when we were young, it's a long time ago for me, but others among you, I can see it's probably a current state of affairs. Young people who are moving about a lot don't religiously go to the post office every time they change lodgings and advise the electoral commissioner of their new address. So that was basically a disastrous idea. And then, of course, proportional representation. I said to your Senator Nick Minchin, who had a great hand in this at the end of the convention, I said, well, there's one thing that will definitely come out of this, and he said, the Republic. And I said, well, I think that probably will, Nick, but the one thing that will definitely come is there'll be no more experiments in proportional representation. Because as a result of the sort of rather elaborate voting system, you had people who basically got no votes at all being elected entirely on preferences, and on preferences which were not disclosed to the people that were casting their votes. Because, as you may recall, if you voted above the line for the ARM or the ACM or whoever you voted for, your preferences were automatically distributed in accordance with the wishes of the group you voted for, and you didn't have a clue, really, and no way of finding out what the ARM or the ACM or any of the other groups were doing with your preferences. And so you had one of the more engaging members of the convention, Misha Schubert from Victoria, was elected. In that state, the quota to be elected was just under 80,000 votes, I think 76,000 votes. Misha received 9,000 primary votes. Nonetheless, she got elected. And indeed, in the Republican movement, of course, we got the most votes. We got about 1.6 million people voted for us. But we were constantly being attacked for being a bunch of elitist swine who are out of touch with the common man or woman, as the case may be. But generally, the fury with which we are accused of being elitist and out of touch, the level of fury increased with a direct relationship, or sorry, in inverse proportion, I beg your pardon, to the number of votes our accusers had. So you had people like Paul Tully, you may have noticed, the gentleman that wore a hat all the time, from Queensland, who got the smallest number of primary votes of any Queensland delegate elected. And of course, Paddy O'Brien, that professor from Western Australia, who was very, very colourful and noisy and very committed to his passionate republicanism, and was elected on Monica's preferences, having got a derisory number of primary votes. So it was a most... so all of that, you know, going down to Canberra, I thought to myself, this is a disaster. This is a convention designed by our opponents. They have succeeded in concocting an electoral system which is calculated to deliver the most bizarre outcomes and often very unrepresentative outcomes. Nonetheless, for some reason or other, it worked. The all sorts of strange things happened. We not only were we able to achieve bipartisanship, support for the convention's republic model from both Liberal leaders and Labor leaders, from both young and old, from people that would be regarded as arch-conservatives and on the one hand, and the Aboriginal representatives on the other. But we even achieved a bit of ecumenism. We got the support of the Anglican Archbishop of Melbourne to our model, as well as the support of the Roman Catholic Archbishop of the Anglican Archbishop of Brisbane and the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne. So we had both sides of the religious divide covered, or at least that particular divide. So it was a remarkable Australian event. This very bizarre group of people. Bizarre, I would say, in the sense that most of the people at that convention would never seek to be elected to a parliament, or if they had sought to be elected, would, one would hope, be elected to a parliament. So you had a remarkable collection. I mean, I will never forget, for as long as I live, the spectacle of Bruce Ruxton and Alf Garland sitting together, reminding me, and I'm afraid to say I actually said this at the convention, reminding me of the two old boys in the theatre box in the Muppet cartoons. And regularly and indiscriminately and without any warning, coming out with the most bizarre, curmudgeonly remarks. I don't know if any of you saw Alf Garland, Brigadier Garland's speech. It was, he only got through a bit of it. He started off with the history of the Garland family. They're monarchists. And started off by saying how the first Garland in the 8th century was a loyal retainer of, you know, Ethelred the Unwieldy or some king or other. And he'd only got up to the 15th century when he ran out of time. Ian Sinclair asked if anyone wanted to move an extension of time. I've never seen so many people sit on their hands. Anyway, I'm told that for a small fee, you can get the entire lineage right up to the present day. And perhaps a horoscope looking into the future. There were some remarkable young people there too. I don't know if any of you saw Jason Lee, a young guy from New South Wales, Australian Chinese background, who really made a most remarkable. He got elected as an independent, which was a bit of, you know, quite an achievement in itself, and made a remarkably cogent and constructive contribution, notwithstanding that he wasn't part of any organised group. You had some very, very persuasive delegates from New South Wales, from South Australia as well, young delegates. Kirsten Andrews was one of the ARM delegates, and Mia Hanshin, who was appointed, were both very good. So all in all, it worked out well. Now, what did the convention actually come up with, and is it any good? I mean, I guess that's the question that lawyers in particular have to ask themselves. Well, the first thing, the key elements in the convention model are a commitment to our parliamentary system of government, a commitment to maintaining and enhancing the integrity of our parliamentary system of representative government, and with the addition of a commitment to bipartisanship. Now, let's have a look at the model. What does it actually involve? We're talking about having a president who will have exactly the same powers and duties as the Governor-General. And the fact that those duties will be the same will be spelled out in the Constitution. Those areas of reserve power, that is to say those areas where there needs to be some flexibility in the system, where the so that a head of state can act to deal with an unthinkable situation, but perhaps a situation where a government has become roguish and is acting flagrantly against the Constitution or whatever. I mean, these are, I think, almost impossible to conceive of in the Australian context. But that flexibility is retained, and so the Constitution will say that the conventions that have hitherto governed the office of Governor General will continue. A number of the advocates for the monarchy, and indeed advocates for having a different republican model, said that it was vital that in any conflict between the President and the Prime Minister must be able to prevail. As you know, at the moment, the Prime Minister in effect appoints the Governor General, just as the Premier in effect appoints the Governor, and of course the Prime Minister can remove the Governor General. The convention model in the field of dismissal, I think, has a most elegant solution which improves on our existing system. Because what the convention recommended was that the Prime Minister can remove the President. That removal, however, must be ratified by a majority vote in the House of Representatives. So a Prime Minister who makes that decision knows that unless he or she has the support of their party in the House, they're dead meat politically. So it's a big roll of the dice for the Prime Minister. But most importantly, the Prime Minister cannot appoint the successor to the President. That can only be done by the two-thirds majority of a joint sitting on the motion of the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. So who fills the casual vacancy? Well, again, the Convention looked to the existing practice and tradition, the senior state governor. So you have this situation. Nowadays, a Prime Minister can sack a Governor-General and put his best mate in, put his oldest crony in, someone that'll do whatever he wants. I mean, again, this doesn't happen very often, probably should never happen, but it can happen. Under these changes that we're proposing, what we will have is a situation where a Prime Minister can sack the President, but he cannot appoint the successor. And until such time as Parliament, by that bipartisan majority, appoints the successor, the senior state governor takes up the job. So unless the Prime Minister has somehow or other managed to have his old mate become a state governor and hang around long enough to be the senior state governor, you have an almost perfect balance between the need for the Prime Minister in a conflict between the head of state and the Prime Minister's office, the need for the Prime Minister to prevail, because the Prime Minister represents the people by reason of the majority in the House of Representatives. But at the same time, the balance, that the integrity of the office is preserved so that it can only be filled on a permanent basis by a bipartisan appointee or on a casual basis by the senior state governor, which of course is what happens now. If the Governor General is out of the country or is invalided or whatever, the senior state governor by convention takes over as administrator. Now, the most important aspect of the convention model, of course, is appointment. I mean, lawyers, because we tend to look at the gloomy side of things all the time and what can go wrong. I mean, if you think about how much, as lawyers, think about how much of your professional life you've spent worrying about what can go wrong and how little speculating on what might go right, it's quite frightening. But let's look at what is most likely. The one thing we know is in the next 100 years there will be probably 20 or more, or maybe a few less, but say 20 governors general or presidents. There'll be 20 people occupying that office. All of them will be appointed. It's most unlikely any of them will ever be dismissed. So appointment is the key. The great improvement to our present system that this model involves is a commitment to bipartisanship. There is nothing that irritates most Australians more than the petty squabbling and factionalism of politics. You know, it is tedious to see a premier, be it a premier or a prime minister, a leader says black, the opposition says white. You know, you get these, the pettiness extends to the fact that you'll find that most premiers and prime ministers will do almost anything they can to avoid being seen on the same platform as their opponent. It's that petty. It's like a football match where you cannot afford to concede an inch to your opponent. And of course that might be fine in a football match, but politics is more important than that. And the one thing all of us know that aren't members of Parliament is that the things that unite us are much more important and far greater in number than the things that divide us. Is it not a great thing for us to say, as we enter the 21st century, not simply that Australia's head of state should be an Australian citizen, but that that office should be filled by somebody who is appointed by the combined vote, the combined support of both sides of the political divide? Isn't it a great thing to be able to say that that office, which after all should be the one office that symbolises the whole nation and seeks to represent the whole nation, should have the support of both sides of politics? Because it seems to me that the Republic is not simply about nationalism. It's not simply about saying our head of state should be an Australian as opposed to the monarch of another country. It's also about national unity. It's also about symbolising in that most concrete fashion that the things that unite us are more important than the things, petty things for the most part, that divide us. So in the mode of selection or appointment of the head of state, we have a concrete example of that kind of unity, that kind of bipartisanship, that I believe the Republic will, to the broader audience, symbolise both within Australia and to the world at large. Now, there was at the convention, and there no doubt remains, agitation or support, canvassing for a popularly elected head of state. And it has been suggested at various times that the Australian Republican movement are just a bunch of elitists not wanting to give the people their say. We've been, you know, compared to Alexander Hamilton, that sort of rather aristocratic centralist in the American Revolution, and our opponents. I saw an article that Fred Cheney wrote recently in Quadrant have compared themselves modestly to Thomas Jefferson. Well, I don't think there's any leading figure in the American Revolution that I would certainly want to compare myself to. Not one of them. What an extraordinary galaxy of talent founded that great republic. But the fact is that we do have a commitment to democracy, all of us. Every single member of every single parliament is directly elected by the people. The Prime Minister is chosen, and as is the State Premier, by reason of having a majority of members in the lower house, be it the House of Assembly or the House of Representatives. Now, the question, therefore, is not, do you trust the people? The question is, do you want to have a president who will have a popular mandate equal to, if not better, than that of the Prime Minister? Now, we said again and again to the advocates of direct election, if you want to have a head of state who is directly elected, at least have the courage of your convictions and say, we want an American model. At least have a system where the head of state is also the head of government, so that you have a president who is quite appropriately directly elected, because that office holder is the chief executive of the nation. But to write out a job description which says the president should be seen to be impartial, should be above party politics, should be the ceremonial head of the nation, and on those hopefully rare occasions of constitutional crisis, will be able to act as an umpire, as in effect almost a judge, act impartially to resolve a partisan crisis. To say all that and then say, and by the way, I want that person chosen in a partisan popular election, is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Because what you've designed is a job that is utterly inappropriate for direct election. It is as stupid as saying that every judge of the Supreme Court or the High Court should be directly elected. And people would say no, that'd be crazy, because people would run on a ticket and they'd say, well, vote for me and I'll do everything I can to make sure that the present Liberal government's activities in such and such a way are scrutinised and, if possible, thwarted, run on a straight political ticket. It would be an abomination. But that is exactly what the proponents of direct election were proposing. There is nothing wrong with directly electing the head of state, as long as that office is also that of head of government. And of course, unless you're prepared to make that major change to an American system, you are creating the potential for all sorts of, constitutional anomalies. Now, a number of people would say in response to those remarks of mine, well, what about Ireland? What about the Republic of Ireland? One could respond by saying, well, what about it? But nonetheless, let's examine it. In Ireland, you have essentially a Westminster type of parliamentary democracy. You have a lower house, which is elected in the way our House of Representatives is, and the Prime Minister is the man or woman that has a majority of members of that house supporting him or her. And in Ireland, the President, who is chosen by a popular vote. But there is one very big difference between Ireland and Australia. And it's the same difference between Austria and Australia. Austria is another parliamentary democracy where the president is elected. And the difference is this. In those countries, there is no imbalance between the upper house and the lower house, because the upper house has no power. You see, the fundamental fact of life is that the Irish president has no political power whatsoever. It doesn't matter, really, what she wants to do. All she can do is give a few speeches, and even then she's meant to get the approval of the Prime Minister for giving them. There is no role as a constitutional umpire. But here in Australia, we have a Senate that is differently constituted to the House of Representatives, where 400,000 Tasmanians choose as many senators as 5.5 million New South Welshmen. It is in strict proportionate terms, not democratic. But we accept it as a democratic institution because it is part of the commitment to federalism that the founding fathers of our Constitution made. And that's why we have equal representation for states in the Senate. We also have a voting system in the Senate that almost ensures that no government will ever have a majority. That Senate has equal power to the House of Representatives. So we have enshrined in our Constitution the capacity for a constitutional crisis to be created between the Senate and the House of Representatives. It's exactly what happened in 1975. It may never happen again, but who knows? It could happen any time. The potential is there. And because the potential is there, you have to have a mechanism for resolving it. Nobody would argue that a key element in that, is not an impartial head of state. After all, that was the critique of John Kerr. John Kerr was said to have acted partially. He was biased, so his critics said. How could you conceive of a situation where you had perhaps an opposition, let's say a Labour opposition in the Senate, with the support of independents, blocking supply, creating a crisis, and the president turns out to be the popularly elected president who was a Labour Party candidate in the presidential election? Nobody, it wouldn't matter if the president acted with complete impartiality, complete objective impartiality, nobody would accept his or her decisions as being anything but partisan. So the point that we, I think those of us that support the convention's recommendations have to get across, is that popular election, to say I want to directly elect the president, is simplistically appealing. But in the Australian context, it is in effect an attack on our system of parliamentary government. We need to be very clear that we have a democratic system, we have a commitment to democracy, we have a commitment to representative democracy, and it follows, therefore, that we are putting our faith in our representatives, our parliamentary representatives, to choose our governments, our ministers, and, in the bipartisan methodology I've described, to choose our president. I might just finish with quotation from Thomas Jefferson. In fact, I looked it up on the World Wide Web this morning, Mr. Attorney, because I was a bit puzzled reading Jefferson. I didn't think that Jefferson was a great supporter of direct election of the American president. And, of course, it turned out that he, in fact, wasn't. So all those direct electionists that say they're Jeffersonian, you'll be able to tell them they don't know they're Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson, in fact, supported the system that the Americans do have of choosing an electoral college, which in the early days functioned much more like an electoral college than it does today. So, in fact, when you vote for the president of America, you vote for a delegate to an electoral college, which in theory is meant to meet, or meets and chooses the president. In fact, it's become a proxy for direct election as the years have gone by. But this is what Jefferson said in 1776. He said, "I've ever observed that a choice by the people themselves is not generally distinguished for its wisdom." This is the great Democrat. "This first secretion from them is usually crude and heterogeneous. But to give to those so chosen by the people a second choice themselves, and they generally will choose wise men." Well, I don't think any of us would agree with all of Thomas Jefferson's sentiments 200 years ago. But there is this element of good sense in it. If you believe in representative democracy, you believe in a system where we choose members of parliament who we trust to sit down together, be it in their party rooms or in the parliament themselves, and to then choose our leaders. That's what representative democracy is all about. That's why we don't directly elect the Attorney General or the Justices of the Supreme Court or the Treasurer. If you have a commitment to representative democracy, then changes to our Constitution, in order to bring our Constitution into an appropriate contemporary Australian context, should be ones that support and enhance that system of representative democracy, parliamentary democracy. And I believe the convention model that will be put to the people, I would say towards the end of 1999, does that. I believe the only risk of us losing is one which, in a sense, all of us here, the media and the legal profession, will be responsible for, and that is the risk of ignorance. We can never underestimate how sadly ill-informed many Australians are about their constitutional and political arrangements. There's no question, and this is now being addressed in the schools today, but there's no question that civic education has been sadly neglected. It's up to us who believe in a republic, and I don't presume that all of you do, but to those of us who believe in a republic, our best ally is information, factual information, explaining to people how the system works today, explaining how the convention's proposal will work in the future. If the extent to which we will succeed is entirely governed by the extent to which we are able to get that information across to the electorate. And I'm sure that the profession, both journalistic and legal, in South Australia will be tireless in its efforts to inform the people so that they make an informed choice for the Republic at the end of 1999. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Turnbull. We'll now take questions from the media and from the legal profession. And I would ask those who are asking questions to give their name, the organisation they represent, before they ask their questions, their crude and heterogeneous questions. Mr. Turnbull.
Yes, I can.
You can. Barbara Turnbull. I had always heard that you were a most aggressive person, and I must admit that as a staunch monarchist...
Mignon, who are you?
I beg pardon?
Mignon, who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mignon Ellicott, former journalist for the ABC. I start again. I always answered that you're an aggressive person, and as a staunch monarchist, I appear to come this much in an aggressive mood. But last night, I listened to your interview on Channel 2, and I was so impressed. I changed my opinion. It was an excellent interview, and congratulations. But I wasn't prepared to hear you say that the populace was ignorant as far as your opinion of republicanism. In your opinion, do you think the average pro-republican has any idea of the number of the billions of dollars that it will take to change our constitution?
Is that the question? Yeah, let me say this to you. I'm not suggesting that that when I say the public, you know, a lot of people are ignorant, I don't mean that in a condescending sense. It's a simple fact that we have not, you know, we have failed. We as a nation have failed. And your national chairman, or the national chairman of Australian Constitutional Monarchy, Lloyd Waddy, and I have often, you know, jointly called for more money and more resources to be put into civic education. I mean, it's just a fact. You know, Australia as a whole has not done a good enough job. As far as the money it will cost to become a republic, it is really very little money indeed. And you don't have to take my word for that. At the Constitutional Convention, the Treasurer, Peter Costello, was asked to get his department to cost what it would in fact cost for us to become a republic. And the conclusion was that if it wasn't a directly elected office, the cost was really almost minimal. The cost of having the convening every 5 years a joint sitting of the Federal Parliament to elect a president was $50,000, estimated at $50,000. There's clearly, in terms of the office of the president and, you know, accommodation and so forth, that's all catered for in the office of Governor General. In terms of things like new coinage, being probably the best example of a change, new coins, of course, are minted every year. There's no suggestion that coins of the Queen's Head would be any more invalid than, you know, in the days when we had pounds, shillings and pence, coins of the head of a deceased king were invalid. I can well remember as a small boy, you know, having Florence, which had the Queen's head on it, and Florence with King George the VI, and occasionally finding one with the head of King George the V. So certainly the view of the Treasury is that the cost is, I wouldn't say it's de minimis, but it is de minimis in the context of the federal budget. So I'm not, you know, there are very good reasons, no doubt, in your mind for opposing the move to a republic, and I respect your opinion, but I'd have to say to you that the issue of cost is really not a relevant one, and I can cite Peter Costello's department's work, not his work, you know, in support of that.
The one they got missed, Rex Jury.
Rex Jury, the Adelaide Advertiser. Thanks, Don. Yes. I too saw your program last night. Well done. Two questions, really, not related. One, assuming we are going to get a republic, would you like to put a date on when it will come in? And Mr. Griffin will no doubt disagree with you. Secondly, what is the medium-term future of the states and territories in our constitutional system? And do you think that ultimately there's going to be an overhaul of that system and that we'll perhaps remove one tier of government from our Australian system?
Well, dealing with the first question first, I think in terms of timing, the referendum will be held at the end of next year. I just don't see mechanically how it can be done much before then. Assuming the referendum is carried, the timing, there are really only two dates from which the Republic could commence. The most obvious is the 1st of January 2001, and that is certainly the policy of the ARM, and it's common sense. It's the centenary of Federation. If you're going to do it, that's the time to do it, and the Prime Minister has said that. The only other candidate, I suppose, is the opening of the Sydney Olympic Games. So I guess there'll be a discussion about that in the course of the year 2000 if the referendum is carried. In terms of the states and territories, this change has no effect on the states and territories. The state governor would continue to be the head of state of, for example, South Australia. He would not represent the Queen. He would be the head of state of that state in the same way that the President is the head of state of the Commonwealth. State governments could decide on their own mechanism for appointing the state governor. They could copy the federal system and have a bipartisan method of appointment, or they could continue to have appointment by the Premier. It would really be up to them. So there'd be no impact at the state and territory level. In terms of abolishing the states, a lot of people are attracted to that idea. And you could say that there's no question that since we became a federation in 1901, there has been a continued shift of power, consistent shift of power from the states to the federal level, and that's all been a function of taxation. I mean, you've seen the tax base of the states shrinking and shrinking to the point where they are in large measure simply spending money given to them by the Commonwealth, and of course he who pays the piper generally calls the tune. But I don't think you would ever get a constitutional majority to abolish the states. I mean, even if you assumed that you could get a majority in New South Wales, just assume that, I don't know that you could. I don't see the Victorians voting to abolish the state of Victoria, and I certainly wouldn't, I mean, you'd be a better judge than I certainly couldn't imagine South Australians or Western Australians or Tasmanians or Queenslanders voting for that, because of course the argument put against it would be all this means is that even more power will be located in Sydney and Canberra than there is today.
Robert Mayne of the Bulletin.
Malcolm, if I may call when a humble journalist like me can cross-examine a barrister. An honest question which deserves an honest answer. Would you like to be a president or a prime minister of an Australian republic?
Well, I can't imagine myself being a president. I think I would... I think I'd say I wouldn't like to be that. And as far as being prime minister is concerned, I think all of us at times would like to be prime minister. But my parliamentary ambitions, for good or ill, are well and truly behind me. I mean, you know that I
was a stripling of 26. I think the nation was probably spared. Perhaps it's a proof positive of the workings of the Holy Spirit in our midst that I didn't win that pre-selection. But in any event, no, I don't think I'm a candidate for either position. Well, what do you want me to say? You know, if nominated, I will not stand. If elected, I will not serve. Was that Adlai Stevenson, I think? And of course, he ran twice, didn't he?
My name's Michelle Lansing. I'm one of the vice presidents of the Liberal Party in South Australia. It's more of a comment, but I suppose it is sort of a question. Just to give you my personal view, I'm quite ambivalent on the whole issue, which I think is quite consistent with a lot of people my age. But I think, as somebody who works in politics every day of my life, I think you actually underestimate the level of feeling within the community against politicians. And I think that your campaign is ultimately going to fail unless you address the issue that people completely mistrust politicians and anything that they perceive putting more power into the hands of politicians to make choices is going to fail.
Yeah, it's a very valid point, and one of great concern, and one that you should be very concerned about, because you know that old saying is right. It doesn't matter who you vote for, you'll always get a politician. The people that at the Constitutional Convention that were noisiest in their denunciation of politicians, Phil Cleary being a good example, were invariably running for Parliament themselves. The paradox, of course, in terms of the mode of appointing the President is very clear. If you give the politicians by a bipartisan two-thirds majority the duty to appoint the President, you will almost certainly not get a politician. It's inconceivable that the Liberal Party would agree to a Labor person being appointed or vice versa. On the other hand, if you have direct election, you will by very definition get a politician. There is nothing more certain, because there are two organisations in this country that have the capacity and the expertise to mount a national campaign, the Labor Party on the one hand and the Coalition on the other. It is almost inconceivable that one of their candidates would not win. And in the event of some, you know, eccentric millionaire like myself running and winning, well, you know, a lot of people would regard me as having some of the characteristics of a politician, except I pay the taxes that the parliamentarians are paid with rather than the other way around. So, again, this is the education issue. I mean, one of the things we have to explain is that you will, in effect, be ensuring a non-political president if you use the methodology proposed by the convention. If you were to have direct election, or indeed a continuation of the existing system, with direct election there's the certainty of a political appointment, and of course with the existing system, from time to time, we know we have political appointments. I mean, Bill Hayden was a blatant political appointment. You can have any view you like about whether he did a good job, but he was put there as a political payback. And that, if we have direct election, we will have Bill Hayden's as president, except instead of being appointed by a prime minister, they'll be nominated by the Labor Party or the Coalition, and they'll win the ballot. Silence.
Crouch from the Sunday Mail.
Oh, no.
What are today's odds of getting the Republic through a referendum? And apart from education, in raw political terms, how are we going to improve those odds?
Well, I'm not a bookmaker, so I don't. I don't know. I mean, it's a two-horse race, isn't it? The status quo or change. I would say the Republic is, slightly better than even money, but I wouldn't put it any higher than that. It's certainly not a certainty. Please. Do you have a question?
Malcolm, at the moment, who do you think...
Who are you?
Grant Heading from Channel 10. Can you give us some names, one or two names, of people who, in the Australian community today, who you think would be acceptable as president of this country? I mean, just to give us a broad idea.
I think what you've probably got to do is look at the sort of people that have been successful governors general. And just, you know, going back, I would say that the type of person that is likely to be chosen by that process is, and I mean, all of these people are individuals, so it's a bit ludicrous, but a William Dean, a Zelman Cowan, a Ninian Stephen. I think that it is, the judiciary are obviously a good source of appointees for this kind of role for two reasons, because they, judges, if they've done their job properly, come, you know, with the image of impartiality. After all, that's their job, to be impartial. And you can't get away from the fact that the office of Governor-General, or indeed the office of President, does have constitutional implications. Now, you can go through a five-year term and never have to worry about the reserve powers, never have to make a difficult constitutional decision, and just do the, you know, the representational ceremonial stuff. That's quite possible. But because of that very important role as constitutional umpire, I think you'll find that people with that judicial background will often be attractive. So, but that's not to say it's an exclusive preserve of the judiciary by any means. You've had a lot of very successful governors and governors general that have come from other backgrounds, from the science academic community, from the armed services, from business, and so forth. But I would say, if you wanted to get an idea of who would be likely to be chosen, I think it is likely to be someone that reminds you of the more successful vice-regal appointments we've had to date.
Good afternoon, Mr. Turnbull. I'm John Belville from LBC Information Services. You may have noticed in a past life as a global company.
Yes, indeed.
Welcome the opportunity to talk to you. Naturally, as legal publishers, anything that requires a rewriting of the law we're in favour of. Much has been made at the cost of becoming a constitution, and you addressed that earlier. What do you perceive as the cost of not becoming one? What's the cost of the nation if we don't progress?
I don't think there's a direct financial cost. I mean, I really don't think dollars come into this debate significantly. I guess the question you have to ask yourself is this: what will we say about ourselves, to ourselves, and to the rest of the world, if in 1999, on the edge of the new millennium, Australia says that not one of its citizens is good enough to be its head of state, that only the King or Queen of England is good enough to be its head of state? What will it say to the rest of the world if we publicly advertise our profound lack of confidence in ourselves and our own people? It's quite a big test, because that inevitably, rightly or wrongly, is how many will see it. It's a question of confidence. Do you believe in Australia? Do you believe in its people? Do you believe that one of us can be our head of state? Or do you believe that not even the very best of us, not the very best Australian, is good enough to be the head of state of Australia? That's a very big call. I shudder to think of the contempt with which we will be viewed, both within this country and abroad, if in 1999 we say, no, there is no Australian good enough to be our head of state. We cannot administer our Commonwealth for the next 100 years without maintaining the King or Queen of England as the top of our constitution. So I think the cost of not becoming a republic is, in fact, in those terms, in those non-assessable terms, very high indeed.
My name is Barbara Adams, and I guess I'm just here as an interested citizen, and I am a monarchist, I'll admit. I may waver in the future, I'm not sure yet. And what I actually was going to say when I asked for the microphone, I will still say, but first let me say that we believe quite steadily that the Queen is only a nominal head of state, and the Governor-General is our head of state, and has been looked upon so by all Prime Ministers since the 1920s, and referred to in many speeches as the head of state, and I feel that he is the head of state. However,
think they're very sensible. Of course you shouldn't vote until you see the amendments, and in fact you'll never be called upon to vote until you do see the amendments. The process that is going to happen now is that Parliament, after consulting with Federal Parliament, after consulting with state and territory governments and parliaments and so forth, will pass a constitution amendment bill. And that bill is like any other bill put before the Parliament to amend an Act of Parliament. It will be called the Constitution Amendment brackets Republic or brackets Australian Head of State Bill of 1999, and it will, you know, say in clause 4, delete this, insert that. It will be just like an ordinary bill which will show exactly what those changes are going to be. That will then go through the Parliament. Once it is passed by the Parliament, it is then put to the people in a referendum. Every voter will receive a copy of the bill and a booklet which has both a yes case and a no case. So everyone will, if they bother to read it, and maybe many people won't, but anyone that bothers to read it will know exactly what they're voting for and the arguments for and against. And then the ballot paper will say Constitution Amendment, you know, brackets Republic Bill 1999, do you approve of the proposed alteration to the Constitution, yes or no? So you're only voting for the changes in that bill and nothing else. So you mustn't ever imagine you're being asked to vote for a blank check or anything like that. You will have every, you know, every comma, every dotted I, every crossed T will be set out in that amending legislation so people know exactly what they've got on the table.
Take two more questions. Malcolm, my name is Jim Maddock. Can I ask whether you have ever met Prince Charles? And if so, what do you think of it?
Well, I actually did meet Prince Charles a very long time ago, but I remember it was at North Bondi Surf Club, nearly 30-odd years ago. But, pardon? It may well have been. I don't know Prince Charles at all. And I guess, you know, I really wouldn't venture an opinion on him. I mean, I think he's. I actually feel quite sorry for the British royal family. I think they have they must wonder sometimes whether they shouldn't just. Give it away. I mean, it's a pretty. I don't think many of us would envy his position. But you know, I take the view. I know Prince Charles is the heir to our throne, and notwithstanding what the lady said would be if the Queen were to drop dead tomorrow, and I hope that doesn't happen, of course. But would be our king. But nonetheless, I really think it's pointless for me to express views on him or his suitability. That's really a matter for the British people.
Hello, Malcolm. Peter Adams from ABC Radio News. What role do you see Australia's non-English migrant population in particular getting us towards a republic?
Well, the role that citizens have is to vote. People, whether they, you know, are people of Aboriginal descent or people like myself of basically of European descent, his families have been in Australia for a long time, or people that have, you know, become naturalised citizens yesterday, all have exactly the same civic rights and obligations. So their right and obligation is to vote. I don't see the ethnic argument as being a huge issue here. I know some people do. I would simply make the point, I guess, that the one thing we have to do is to ensure that all of our national symbols and institutions reinforce and underline the things we have in common. That is to say, the fact that we're Australian, the fact that we live in Australia, and the fact that we're committed to this country's unique democracy and political values and institutions. And it's appropriate, it seems to me, to be appropriate that those shared values should be represented by symbols that are unequivocally Australian. You know, when people talk, say that the British monarchy represents our heritage, well, I don't know that it represents our heritage. Certainly much of our heritage is British, And I think that heritage is valued by all Australians, regardless of their background. But surely, given that our heritage and our cultural heritage, particularly in Australia, is so diverse, we really shouldn't be picking and choosing. We should be saying that above all else, we're Australia. And we should have an institution that says our head of state should be the best Australian for the job, and that the only qualification is to be Australian. I mean, that, you know, how do you make a case for Australia, for example, being... Well, let me give you a good example. The Section 116 of our Constitution says that no office or public trust under the Commonwealth should be subject to any religious test. So you don't have to be a member of the Anglican Church to be the Chief Justice, or you don't have to be a Roman Catholic to be the, you know, the Speaker of the House of Representatives or whatever. There is no religious test for any office, and I don't think anyone would argue against that. But we have our head of state, the King or Queen of England, by the laws of England, must be a member of the Anglican Church and cannot by law be married to a Roman Catholic. So how do you, you know, so we've got, that to those people who say the Queen is the Queen of Australia and this is an Australian institution, you can simply point to the Constitution and say it's at odds with the principles in our Constitution, which have been there since 1900. So, you know, I guess in the context of the cultural and religious and ethnic diversity in this nation, what we should be doing is rejoicing in and reinforcing that diversity, which I think is one of our greatest strengths, but saying that our national institutions should honour every aspect of our cultural diversity and every part of our heritage, and it does so by being Australian and not being British or Catholic or Greek or anything. The only qualification to be the head of state of Australia should be that you're an Australian citizen who has the confidence of your fellow Australians. There's nothing more required, and frankly, no greater honour could be bestowed.
Thank you very much. I was going to say thank you very much to the first President of the Republic of Australia, but that would be too glib for a speech which I thought made us actually think, and it was pretty profound, and thank you very much for it.
Thank you.
I also have to give you something I'd like to keep for myself. It is absolutely wonderful, and if you feel that this is a sort of token thing and you feel it to be offended by it, we'll make other arrangements. Turnbull.